Good afternoon, everybody. Please be seated. This is case number 69208, Public Employees Retirement System of Nevada versus Gitter. Mr. Wicker, Mr. Kennedy, Mr. Wicker, you ready?
Yes, Your Honor.
Did you want to reserve some time?
I would like to reserve 4 minutes, Your Honor.
Okay, keep it out of the clock.
Mr. Chief Justice Sherry, Justices, good afternoon. With me today is Mr. Chris Nielsen, who's the General Counsel for PERS, and Mr. John Murtha, who's the Managing Shareholder for Woodburn & Wedge.
Welcome to the Supreme Court.
In this case, PERS agrees that the result of its denial of Ms. Gitter's claim leads to a harsh result. And this court has had to hear other PERS cases that led to harsh results. For example, in Smith versus PERS, a judge missed a filing deadline by 3 days and didn't qualify for what he wanted. In Harper versus PERS, honorably serving firemen had their benefits reduced when an audit revealed that they were overpaid in Las Vegas. But PERS has a fiduciary duty to follow its statute. And sometimes it leads to harsh results like we have here. For example, the survivor beneficiary benefit that we're here talking about today did not even come into law until 2001. And so before that time, any PERS member that was unmarried at the time of their death, their benefits were simply lost. And so the legislature added this benefit in 2001. Since PERS is a defined benefit plan and it has to follow its statute, any fixes for unjust results or inequitable results like may have occurred here are up to the legislature to fix. PERS cannot ignore its statute in order to achieve what might be an equitable result. Now, the nature of this case involves a claim by Ms. Gitter for a survivor beneficiary benefit. Ms. Gitter's mother, Christine Freshman, was a 24-year PERS member, and she named Ms. Gitter as her survivor beneficiary in 2007. In 2009, Ms. Christine Freshman was murdered by her spouse, Walter Freshman. Walter Freshman was convicted of second-degree murder in 2010, in November of 2010. For purposes of our discussion today, Mr. Freshman is considered a killer. When a member dies while they're employed and married, normally a spousal benefit is payable. That's required by the statute. However, and it falls under heading in the PERS statute under spouses. However, the PERS Act made Mr. Freshman the killer ineligible to receive wound spousal benefit, and that's 286-669. In June of 2011, PERS determined that since Christine Freshman was married at the time of her death, Ms. Gitter was not eligible for a survivor beneficiary benefit. Under 286-6767, in order for somebody to be considered a survivor beneficiary, the member has to be unmarried at the time of their death. That's expressly set forth in the statute.
I think, Mr. Wicker, I think we understand all that in the Chapter 286, but what about, as the court concluded in NRS 41B310, subsection 3, my law says that the husband predeceases the wife under these circumstances, therefore the daughter would be a beneficiary under PERS. So why shouldn't we harmonize that statute with Chapter 286 like the district court did?
The district court erred because it found that there was an interest going to Mr. Walter Freshman to which I'll call it the General Slayer Statute, 41B, attached. It, just like the PERS has to examine its statute carefully, I think you need to examine 41B carefully too. And if you look at 41B, under 41B090, a governing instrument is defined. And within that definition is the PERS Act. And I think everybody here today agrees that the PERS Act, which is Chapter 286, is a governing instrument.
Are you asserting that then any governing instrument, if private insurance companies, any other insurance company, has a similar provision, you would approach it the same way? This specific survivor statute would be inapplicable?
Well, I think you have to look at the specific language to see how that works. In this case, the PERS Act had its own version of the Slayer statute, 286-669.
But does it provide that it's exclusive against all other statutes?
Well, it provides that...
That's a yes or no.
No, it does not. But it does provide that under 669, Mr. Freshman was ineligible to receive any benefit from the governing instrument, which is the PERS Act. And if you look at 41B, under the general rule, 41B.200 states as follows. Notwithstanding any other provision of law, the provisions of this chapter apply to any interest, any interest or benefit that accrues or devolves to a killer of a decedent based upon the death of the decedent. Now, in this case, the statute provides for spousal benefit. However, under the PERS Act, under the governing instrument, Mr. Freshman was ineligible to receive any benefit under the PERS Act.
Well, let me ask you this. Let's say the day that this woman died, her husband had died the day before. So the husband predeceased the decedent.
Then at that...
that point, the child would have been eligible, though she was an adult, to receive those survivor benefits, correct?
That's correct, because Ms. Freshman would have been unmarried at the time of her death.
So if you credit that 41B.310.3 says if a killer kills someone under the governing instrument, the forfeiture must be treated as if the killer had predeceased the decedent, why doesn't that apply to the PERS statute? And you say, okay, we treat this as if the woman had predeceased, the husband had predeceased the wife.
Because you have to read the entire section, Your Honor. Under 41B.310, subsection 1 says, except as otherwise provided, a killer of a decedent forfeits any appointment, etc., interest or benefit that, pursuant to the provisions of a governing instrument, executed by the decedent or any other person, accrues or devolves to a killer based upon the death of a decedent. Now, if you look at the governing instrument, which is the PERS Act, there was no benefit that accrued or devolved to Mr. Freshman because the PERS Act cuts that off, makes him ineligible to receive any benefit. So under 41B.310.1, there is no forfeit that occurs because Mr. Freshman had no benefit or interest that was devolving to him. You know, devolving or accruing to him means that you are acquiring an enforceable right. And that didn't happen under the governing instrument. Now, Justice Pickering, if you look at subsection 3, the one that you were looking at, it states, if a killer of a decedent forfeits any appointment, interest, or benefit pursuant to this section, the provisions of each governing instrument affected by the forfeiture must be treated as if the killer had predeceased the decedent. So this only comes into play if the Slayer statute affects a forfeiture of the spousal interest that was due to Mr. Freshman. And that did not happen in this case because the PERS Act, which is the governing instrument, cut off the interest, made him ineligible, and so there was no interest for the Slayer statute to attach to. There's another issue involved also. If you look at...
But it says the provisions of each governing instrument affected by the forfeiture. So why wouldn't the 286, treating that as the governing instrument, be something that was affected by the forfeiture? I think I understand your point, but it's a pretty exiguous line of reasoning, isn't it?
No, I think it's giving the express words of the statute effect in a reasonable manner, because it refers back to Section 1 of 310.
Well, but it's because you want to read 286 first before this one. I mean, it seems to me that 286 would still have meaning in other contexts, it's just not the spouse as the killer.
Well, I think under this statute, you have to read 286 as a whole. This court, I think, in order to get to where you're talking about, Your Honor, you have to say that somehow the Slayer statute preempts 669, the PERS Slayer statute, and say that really has no meaning here. We're going to just ignore that and say that the spousal interest is a benefit to which the general Slayer statute attaches. And Section 3 of 310 is very clear that if a forfeiture occurs as a result of Section 1, then the predeceased provision takes place. Subsection 1 says, talks about if there's a forfeiture, if pursuant to the provisions of the governing instrument, there is an interest to be forfeited by reason of the Slayer statute. And under the PERS Act, which is the governing instrument, there is no interest, there is no benefit that Mr. Freshman had, which is forfeited by the general Slayer statute. Now, I understand that you have to read this statute closely, but I think that's what PERS has to do to follow its fiduciary duty, is to read the statute, give every word a fact, and then determine whether or not a benefit is due to Ms. Gitter.
Okay. Mr. Worker, I know we have some other issues. You've certainly covered the main issue in the case, but we have interest, costs, attorney's fees. If I could ask you about the attorney's fees here, the judge, my understanding, awarded him under 18010 for not having a proper defense, you know, for delaying the case, and made a personal award of sanctions. I mean, I assume you feel this is good. It was good faith litigation. Whether we agree or disagree with you on this point,
yeah. Well, it's clear that whether or not you prevail on the main issue, the question is not whether you prevail or not. The question is whether the litigation was pursued in good faith, based on existing law or a modification of law. And in this case, pursued this, represented by their counsel, based on the express provisions of the law, as they did their best to combine the two and see how it worked. And I've just explained to you how PERS saw that the Slayer statute did not attach to any interest, and therefore it was proper to deny the interest of Ms. Gitter.
Okay. Can I ask you about the issue of interest? The court awarded interest under NOS 99040, which is the contract rate of interest, as opposed to, let's say, 17.130. What's your position if we disagreed with you and we affirmed the judgment as to what statute should be used to calculate the interest?
This is kind of a deceptively important issue, Your Honor, because the plaintiffs in this case asserted that there was a contract that existed between PERS and Ms. Gitter was a third-party beneficiary, so a contract between Christine Freshman and PERS. And this court has held in the Nichols case and Washoe County case that there is a contract for the right to achieve, be a member of PERS between the public employer and the public employee. This court has never held that PERS actually is subject to a contract for benefits. You know, the statute is very detailed and very explicit that PERS' duty to pay benefits is statutorily based, and there is no contract. There's no elements of contract between PERS and Ms. Freshman in order to use 99040 PRINF 1, which is the contract rate of interest. PERS asserted that under its statute, which is, I think, 286-200, that lists the expenses that can be paid out of the trust fund, that not listed there is prejudgment interest. However, if the court disagrees with PERS on that, then the prejudgment interest that would be applicable would be under 17.130, which is the prejudgment rate of interest on judgments. There is no contract here for which to assert the contract rate of interest. And it makes a difference. The contract rate leads to a figure of about $69,000 as of September 2015, and the prejudgment rate leads to an amount of about $13,000 on that same period of time.
You have less than a minute left. Want to reserve some time? I'll give you a couple extra minutes.
Yes, thank you, I'll
Give you a total of 3 minutes, and I'm going to give Mr. Kennedy 17 minutes.
Thank you. 3 minutes when I come back?
Yeah, you'll have three.
Okay, thank you.
You had about a minute left. I'm giving you two extra, and then I'm giving Mr. Kennedy 2 extra.
Thank you.
Even-handed. Mr. Kennedy.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. Dennis Kennedy for Shea Gitter and Jared Schaefer in cases 69208 and 669939, and the same two as real parties in interest in 69961. As the court's correctly pointed out, we've got essentially three issues here. The first is interpretation of statutes, which is a de novo review. This is Chapter 41B and Chapter 286. The second is the prejudgment interest, which is an application of the statute. And the third is an award of attorney's fees, which is subject to the substantial abuse of discretion review standard. First thing to point out is the first issue I was going to argue was whether or not PERS is subject to Chapter 41B at all. That's the position that PERS has taken throughout these proceedings. They've initially said, look, we're not subject to that. We're only subject to 286. Counsel has conceded today that Chapter 41B does apply to PERS. And so they've apparently abandoned the argument that PERS is not subject to that chapter at all. So the second issue is the two provisions, the two statutes, can they be read and can they be harmonized? And the answer is that they can. The argument that's made is, well, you just can't put these two together. They somehow nullify each other and render this some sort of an incomprehensible mess. That's not true at all. If you look at the PERS Slayer statute, 286-669, that statute simply says, and I'll summarize it, the Slayer can't take. If the Slayer's entitled to something, the Slayer can't take. And that's all it says. There's some other language in there about what PERS does if this is determined, but that's all it says. If you then go to 41B, 41B 310 says essentially the same thing. Slayer can't take. So those, to read those side by side, they say the same thing. But 41B goes on beyond that. And 41B 310 goes on to say, and if the Slayer can't take, here's what happens next. The Slayer is then deemed to have predeceased the decedent. And of course, the introductory provision of Chapter 41B says, notwithstanding any other provision of law, this is what happens. So you have two chapters. Both of them start out by saying, Slayer can't take. Then 41B, which is adopted about 20 years after the PERS Act, says, and if the Slayer can't take, and somebody else is named a beneficiary, the Slayer is deemed to have predeceased the decedent. Nothing inconsistent about those two chapters. Read them together, and they have a two-step process. So that argument fails. You can take those two, read them together in absolute harmony.
Well, does 289.310 make 41B completely meaningless then?
No.
Explain to me what the 286 would apply to.
Well, 286 is simply a general statement that if the Slayer is 286 is a prohibition on the Slayer taking.
Right.
It doesn't say anything else about what happens if there's another.
No, I get that there's more in 41A, but what's left, what job does 286 have left if you read this as you're saying?
It doesn't have anything else on that provision to do. It simply says Slayer doesn't take. And 41B
says the same thing.
It says same thing, and then it says, and if the Slayer doesn't take, the Slayer is deemed to have predeceased the decedent. Something that 286 doesn't say,
Are there any situations where 286.669 would apply but not 41B.310?
I don't think so, because it simply says Slayer doesn't take, and if you go to 41B, that's, it says the same thing.
So are you saying that the later statute impliedly repeals the earlier one?
You could read it that way. You could say it impliedly repeals, and here's why I can say that with some confidence. If you look at the provisions of 41B, if you look at 41B.200, it starts out by saying, notwithstanding any other provision of law, these provisions apply. So it's more, I guess.
And that's the coverage of the whole 41B. Yeah, so you think that was just the legislature didn't want a clean house, so they left it on the books?
I think so. I've seen other situations where the legislature passes a statute, and then you can find something that's still on the books out here.
There are many inscrutable statutes. I get that.
Right. So the interest issue.
Mr. Kennedy, before you go to that, could I ask you a question?
Yes.
Because it relates to what I understand Mr. Wick's argument to be, and maybe I've got his argument wrong, so he can clarify this maybe when he comes back up to the podium. I'd like to read a portion of Section 310.1, if you could follow along with me, and then I'll have a question about a portion of it. Read it this way. A killer of a decedent forfeits any benefit that, pursuant to the provisions of a governing instrument executed by the decedent or any person, accrues or devolves to the killer. Per's argument, as I understand it, says that governing instrument in this context refers to the PERS statutes that construct the PERS system. But I wondered about this argument because it doesn't take into account the words executed by the decedent.
Exactly right.
So I wondered if you'd comment on the import of those words to the argument I understand Mr. Wicker to be making about the significance of the term governing instrument.
Yeah, the governing instrument executed by the decedent is the survivor beneficiary designation. That was, I think it's the only document executed by the decedent. It's in the appendix at 0064. And this is the document that confers upon the killer his rights. He is the primary beneficiary under the document. The secondary or survivor beneficiary is the daughter, Shea Gibb. So when the statute talks about a governing document executed by the decedent, it can only be referring to the survivor beneficiary designation.
41B, read in that manner, would not invalidate the interest to the secondary beneficiary.
No, it would not invalidate the interest of the secondary beneficiary.
It would only invalidate the interest to the killer.
That is right. Yeah, that's correct. And that's exactly what happened here. 41B invalidates the killer's interest and then says the killer is deemed to have been, to have predeceased the decedent. So you're exactly right with respect to that. The governing instrument in this case can't be the PERS Act because the decedent didn't execute the PERS Act. Obviously. The third issue is the interest. In a what became kind of a familiar refrain in the trial court, PERS said, they said to Judge Crockett, interest, we're not required to pay interest. PERS doesn't pay interest at all. That was their position. It's our position here, too, is that PERS doesn't pay interest. And I don't have to dwell on what happened in the trial court, but the result was the trial court said, yes, PERS has to pay interest. Everybody has to pay interest on judgments that are entered against them. And the trial court then said, look, under the old statute 990401A, because the employment agreement between Ms. Freshman and the school district was in 1986, where the statute still said 12%. In 87, the statute was amended. So this situation is never going to occur again, because it's amended to prime rate plus two. But back then, on that statute, it is a contract, and 99040 doesn't say in litigation between parties to a contract, as PERS is argued, saying PERS is not a party. It says in cases upon contracts. This is a case upon a contract. This right is created out of the employment contract between the school district and Ms. Freshman. This is an action upon that contract because PERS, as the trustee, as the administrator of the pension, said, we're not going to pay it. This is an action upon that contract.
But the daughter is not a party to that contract. She is just a beneficiary under that form.
That's right.
So how can you bootstrap the daughter into that argument that her mother was an employee of the school district and therefore with PERS?
Precisely the point that I made. The action, the statute doesn't say in an action between parties to a contract. If it said that, you're right, and I can't bootstrap. But it doesn't say that. It says in actions upon a contract. This was an action upon a contract by essentially a third-party beneficiary of that contract. Next, the next item is the attorney's fees. And PERS argues in the brief, they didn't argue here today because their time was squeezed a little bit, but they argue in the brief, they say, oh, look at all the things Judge Crockett said. Why, this indicates an abuse of discretion. Look at all the things he's asking us about what we did and what we should have done and did we try to do anything. Here's why he said that. You start with the proposition that PERS is a fiduciary, which is admitted by all the parties here. And because they're a fiduciary, PERS said, look, in the court below, and this is of course subject to the manifest abuse of discretion standard, they said in the court below, you have to give some deference to our interpretation of these statutes. After all, we're a fiduciary, and we administer these statutes, and we have all of these people to whom we are fiduciaries, and when we look at how we administer these statutes, you have to give deference to that. Now, the argument I make here is there's no deference required, but the argument that was made down there, what Judge Crockett said and all of the quotes that are in the brief from him, Judge Crockett said, well, look, if you are a fiduciary, what in the world are you doing in this case? If you're a fiduciary and you owe a duty to Shay Gitter, why aren't you trying to help her? Why are you withholding documents? He said, why are you throwing bricks in her path every time she tries to pursue these benefits? Why aren't you doing that? That's the context in which those questions were asked, because that's an issue raised by PERS saying, you have to trust us to do the right thing. He said, I don't think you're doing the right thing.
I'm sure Mr. Wicker will say it was the litigation over statutory interpretation, and they had a reasonable belief that 669, 286669 trumped the 41B. So what would your response to that be?
Right. And there's a lot more to it than that. This went on for some time, and I didn't know if I would, but I think I've got enough time to go through this, okay? This was a long fight with PERS. 8 days after the killing, PERS sends a letter to Ms. Gitter saying, you might be entitled to some benefits. And this is 73 in the appendix. At 80 to 88, Jerry Schaefer, the administrator of the estate, writes to PERS and says, okay, I have an order here directing me as the administrator to collect monies due from PERS. So what are we going to do? PERS responds at 123, 124 of the appendix saying, nope, you're not entitled to any benefits. No explanation other than this is what the PERS statute says. But 3 weeks later, PERS writes another letter to Ms. Gitter And this letter said, this is after they said you don't get anything, they write another letter and it says, this is at 75 of the appendix, you may be entitled to receive $2,900 a month for your lifetime. If you're interested, complete this claim form. Of course, right after that, the husband's adjudged guilty, and now, at the appendix at 66, Ms. Bitter reapplies, and Jerry Schaefer says at 479 and 480, okay, we want you to reconsider this. June 10th of 2011, at page 78 of the appendix, PERS writes back, denied, there's nothing in the PERS Act that gives you any benefits. This is after they told her, twice you may be entitled. Schaefer gets back to them, appendix 482, and says, details, please? What are you talking about? Can you give me any details? No response. 488 of the appendix, he resends. Then he calls and says, can somebody please tell me what's going on? No response at all. October 21st of 2011, the estate's closed. The estate just gets closed with nothing being done on this. In May of 2012, and Ms. Gitter had counsel, May of 2012, she comes to my office as a referral from the Pro Bono Project, saying, can somebody look at this? Because it just doesn't seem right. And Kelly Stout of my office, who I've got to tell you deserves most of the credit in this case, takes this cause repeatedly. Ms. Stout is after PERS saying, I want to see the file. We don't have a single document. I want to see the file on this. Is she the secondary beneficiary? PERS says, no. He won't show you the file. Nothing. We get them commission as special administrator and say, could we now see it? No. We represent everybody. Could we see it? No. Finally, we go to court and get a court order. And the probate court says, give them the file. And we get it, and sure enough, what do we find? This document. She's the secondary beneficiary. If I can conclude just by one thing. So there was a long fight, if I may.
Yes, absolutely. Justice, absolutely.
Long fight over this. PERS, and every single step of the way, they fought for well over a year until we could get a court order. And in the end of all of this, in the final scene on the argument for attorney's fees in front of Judge Crockett, summary judgment has been entered. Interest has been assessed. Costs have been awarded. Judge Crockett explains to the PERS representative and their counsel, and this is all out of the transcript, he says, your conduct was unreasonable, it was vexatious, it was unconscionable. You strung together some beads and tried to choke her with it. Given all of that, Judge Crockett then says, and this is at, in the appendix, in the transcript, Judge Crockett says to Mr. Wicker, let me give you a hypothetical. If this all happened again, what would PERS do? And Mr. Wicker says, they do the same thing, they deny the benefits. And Judge Crockett says, two pages later, I'm assessing attorney's fees in this case. That is a textbook definition of vexatiousness. After all of this plays out, to say, doesn't bother us. We do the same thing. That's vexatious.
Justice Gibbons has a question.
Mr. Kenney, I understand all that, but the award was also made against Mr. Wicker and the firm pursuant to Chapter 7. Is that appropriate? I mean, isn't he just representing his client and the firm's retained to represent PERS? Why should they be assessed personally?
Well, the statute says that. And Mr. Wicker actually was the individual who Judge Crockett put that question to. He said, are you going to do the same thing again after all of this? He said, yes.
But if PERS said litigate that, we don't agree with the Judge Crockett's statutory interpretation, isn't that a good faith litigation, though, to do that under the circumstances?
I don't think you can read these statutes the way that they read them. And the years of going on with the dispute, if I can read you talking about vexatiousness.
Mr. Kinney, I have to cut you off.
All right, I'm done. Okay.
Thank you. Mr. Wicker, I'll give you 4 minutes, total 4 minutes. I'm a big clock watcher up here. I'm trying to be fair.
You're easy on time.
I'm trying to be.
Let me talk about the attorney's fees for just a little bit. I think Mr. Kennedy greatly exaggerates what occurred here in this case. And they make a big deal that PERS did not provide the file to Ms. Gitter. And under 286, 110, and 117, there are a limited number of people who PERS can provide the file to. And so when Ms. Gitter asked to see the file, it was after PERS had determined that she was not a beneficiary. And they determined that according to the statute 6767, which said that Ms. Freshman had to be unmarried at the time of her death in order for it to apply. So PERS cannot give them the file. They have to get a court order. That's
what about,
statutory.
Mr. Wicker, what about the estate? If the estate requested the file,
the estate is not listed in the statute as somebody entitled to see the file. It's the member, the spouse, beneficiary, or by court order. And the estate is not listed as being entitled to the order. I mean, the court file. And indeed, it happens all the time. Like, for example, where ex-spouses want to see the file, they just go get a court order. PERS never opposes those things, but the statute requires a court order. So they got a court order in December of 2013, and December of 2014, in January of 2014, PERS provided the file. In March of 2014, the lawsuit was filed, and that was the first time that the Woodburn Law Firm became involved in all of this, was after the litigation was filed.
Mr. Wicker, is there an explanation as to why, based on the chronology that was given, PERS sent out information to your daughter?
Yes, I think I think it can be attributed to this, Justice Douglas, is that, as you know, PERS deals with thousands upon thousands of people, and when they got notice that Ms. Gitter had passed away, somebody in the office saw in the file that there was this survivor beneficiary form, and so they sent out a letter alerting Ms. Gitter that she may be entitled to benefits. Subsequent to that, the facts came out that Mr. Gitter not only murdered Ms. Freshman, but he was convicted of the murder, and so the PERS statute 286-669 comes into play to make him ineligible to receive any benefits. And as a result of that, the letter saying that she may have a benefit were rendered null because Mr. Freshman was convicted of the murder. He's not entitled to any benefits. And then they look at the history and see that Ms. Freshman was married at the time of her death, and so the survivor beneficiary benefit does not apply. I would note that in terms of attorney's fees also, this is a case of first impression, whether or not the general slayer statute preempts the PERS slayer statute and inserts itself into the determination of benefits. PERS, I think, made a reasonable reading of the statutes, and I would still urge you to consider that reading, because I think it's the right reading of how the slayer statute works. It is focused on the benefit that the spouse may have been entitled to. He was entitled to no benefit, and so the slayer statute doesn't apply. On prejudgment interest, this case was not a case upon a contract. This was a case, as decided on the motion for summary judgment, declaratory relief was granted, enforcing what the judge thought was the requirements of the statute. This was not a case on a contract, and the contract rate of interest is not applicable to these circumstances. That's important to PERS because I think it's important for this court to determine whether or not there is a contract between a PERS and a third-party beneficiary or PERS and a member, because that comes up all the time. And your cases thus far have not gone that far, and I don't think it's appropriate because it's a statutory duty that PERS has.
Thank you, Mr. Wicker. Both counsel, I've known both of you for a long time. I expected a good argument, and you lived up to my expectations. I'm sure you lived up to the expectations of my colleagues. This case, along with 69208, 69939, and 69961, all three cases will be submitted. Thank you.